Hello and welcome to Inside Exercise. I'm Emeritus Professor Glenn McConnell from Victoria University, and I'm also currently a Danish Diabetes and Endocrine Academy Visiting Professor at the University of Copenhagen. The idea behind Inside Exercise is to bring to you the absolute who's who of exercise research. So what I want is for you to get your information about exercise from the research experts rather than influencers. And today, for the first time, I'm bringing to you a rising star, a new investigator, someone who's very clearly going to be a who's who of exercise research, Dr. Carlos Henriques Onken from the University of Copenhagen in Denmark, who is clearly going to end up being a who's who of exercise research. He's been doing really remarkable work on reactive oxygen species and exercise. I met him 7 years ago when I was at the University of Copenhagen doing a research visit, and he was a PhD student. Straight away, I could see he was going to be a real rising star. He would present at every meeting, really keen, trying all sorts of different methods. And as he discusses, it's not easy coming from a country like Chile, where they have very few resources, equipment, to then, you know, do great research. So he's had to move to the University of Copenhagen, and he's indeed done fantastic research. He's already won 2 awards in his short career. So he won the Young Investigator at the International Biochemistry of Exercise Conference Award. So the first time someone from Latin America has won that award. And he's also won an award related to his reactive oxygen species research itself. So I found this really interesting. I think you will too. So stick around. Hi, Carlos. How are you? Thanks for coming on to Inside Exercise.
Hi, Glenn. Nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's funny, we're both in Copenhagen, but as happened with Lars Nebo, I had to say at the start, I'm not set up to do, like, you know, 2 people together. So you're at home on Zoom and I'm on Zoom as well. So now you're the first of the rising stars. So this is a bit of a new thing. So, you know, the whole idea is I interview the who's who of exercise research. And then, you know, a few people said here and there, well, what about people you can tell are going to be who's who one day? And, you know, everyone started off, they went a who's who. And I think you tick that bill perfectly. Carlos is, I actually call you King Carlos around here.
Yes.
It's funny because I said, does anyone else call you King Carlos? No. Okay. Fair enough.
No,
fourth research visit here. But the second one, when I was here, I came for 6 months. And there's this young chap, turned out to be Carlos, that every lab meeting, whether it's a section meeting and then the next week it's the group meeting, and I'd go to them both. Every meeting, he got up and presented reactive oxygen species. And I'd been doing stuff on that, and I'm like, okay, let's see what this guy's got. And it was impressive.
Yeah. Thank you very much, and thank you for the opportunity. It's very nice to be here. You know, we have discussed this before, but it was so inspiring with your paper with Troy Mary in exercise and contraction induced glucose uptake by Ross. I read so many papers of you, and now it's at least unexpected to be here and being interviewed by you. It's that's how science is.
Nah, I kept thinking, as I said, I was very impressed with you, and then you've continued. So that was 2016. You were getting up like every lab, and they'd say, they'd have like a long presentation and a short presentation. Who can do the long presentation next week? It's your turn, isn't it? And then who can do the short? Your turn. And then Carlos, I can go again. And every time you had like new data, you were trying new methods, and it's like, holy crap. So it's really good. And then, so I guess, why don't we start off, you know, how you got to be where you are, because you're from Chile, and even, you know, just a sort of a bit of a spoiler alert, you know, the first person from Latin America to win the Young Investigator Award at the International Biochemistry of Exercise Conference. And indeed, you know, that's why I started thinking, look, let's get this guy on. But, you know, you've had challenges. It's interesting to come from there, and you were applied at the start, which was interesting as well. Mm-hmm. So why don't you give us a bit of a background on you, how you ended up here?
Yeah. Long story. So I'm from Chile, from a small city close to Santiago, the capital, which is called Los Andes. And in this city, I started doing gymnastics when I was at primary school. So really get into sports and decide to actually maybe I want to study sports science because I want to be the head of the national team of gymnastics from Chile or something like that. So I was thinking that could be kind of my future. But then in the bachelor, I took physiology and I just love it. And then maybe I said, maybe also like maybe more the scientific part of a sport. So I will try to follow that. And yeah, so that's how everything started. And mostly, I think more or less everyone start similarly liking a sport, combining it with a little bit of curiosity. And after my bachelor, I did a little bit of research in with the athletes and very applied physiology, mostly training related research. But then I wanted to learn a little bit more about what happened inside of the muscle. So I started a master in physiology at the University of Chile. And then I joined this lab from Enrique Jaimovic, which is a cell biology lab. Mostly they study muscle, but it's very basic science. They do real amazing, but mostly muscle in a dish, right? So
Yeah. So during the applied, because it's that always interests me, because I was the same. I was doing more applied as a distance runner, and then I it became more mechanistic, but sort of gradually over time. Mm. I never would have thought that I would just, you know, joined a cell biology lab. Was it the reputation of the person? Like, what made you do that sort of switch for more applied?
So it was on one side, it was, I want to know more about the mechanistic aspect of exercise physiology, but I think sports science in those days in Chile was not really developed. So we were mostly doing really basic measurements. We didn't have the equipment to do VO2 max or those stuff. We basically did what we could because we just like it, but it was really hard to actually do research. But this was a lab from, which is really well known in Chile, but it was a lab from the Faculty of Medicine. So they have resources to actually do research, right? So to actually get maybe reagents, salary and everything. So it was moving by curiosity, but was also, I saw the opportunity to do a little bit more research with funding. Funding was there, but was not in that time in exercise physiology or sports science because it was not really a thing actually in Chile those days.
That's true. So you didn't have access. Some of the things we take for granted in the West, you know, like, I mean, sometimes you've got to hunt around a little bit, but you know, ability to do a VO2 max, for example. So when you said you didn't have much equipment, I assumed you could do a VO2 max, but I thought you were saying, you know, maybe muscle biopsies or, you know, like measuring, you know, Western blots or something. You were talking about right down to the basic sort of level. So you just be able to do a heart rate or something like that. Mm.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. And was mostly built by, stuff were built by our own hands. And that's kind of research we were doing. And we spent a lot of time trying to keep it up. But then I said, like, okay, it will be really difficult to publish this stuff because reviewer will always ask for something more like why you didn't measure, I don't know, force production during the jump. We were doing a lot of plyometric exercise and training. So why you didn't use a force platform? Don't have a force platform. So it's kind of those stuff. And I mean, in Chile, those days, at least when I was in my bachelor, we didn't have access really to the journals. I mean, was that kind of limitation you have. And then of course, internet gave us access to the online versions, but we didn't have access to journals. So it was a bit difficult to do. So moving to maybe medical science, there were more resources, more opportunities to do new stuff. So that's one thing. And the other thing, I was really interested in the biology of exercise.
Mm-hmm. But then cell culture, it's a bit hard, you know, people who have done it and we tried to do it ourselves at one stage, contracting cells and things like that. Was that part of what you were thinking? Like, oh, maybe I can contract the cells? Or were you just thinking, I want to learn sort of basic sort of methods?
Yeah, at the beginning it was mostly I want to learn, I said. So I joined a project about Duchenne muscular dystrophy, working with MDX cells, myotubes mostly. Mm-hmm. So we were interested in how gene expression is actually dysfunctional. And in that lab, they were studying NF-kappa B. I joined the lab, and then I said, what about if we do electrical stimulation and see NF-kappa B activity? And then I started reading a little bit, and then I came out with all the IL-6 papers. Those days were peak about the myokines. And then I started using drugs to inhibit some of the raw sources in that time. Heitmann's lab was one of the first describing NOX2 functions in muscle. So maybe NOX2 is activated during exercise.
Actually, maybe just when you bring up those sort of terms, maybe just tell people, I know we'll talk more about it, but you know, just.
Yeah, we'll talk, yeah.
Yeah, NOX2 and things like that. Maybe just say that you're talking about a kind of enzyme, it is what it does, whatever.
Yeah. So we will. We were interested in this enzyme, which is an enzyme. We will talk a little bit later, I guess, about that. That is it's a professional reactive oxygen species production enzyme. I just wanted to do research in exercise, but we didn't have treadmills in the lab, so I started doing swimmings in the mice and looking at the gene expression. And that's how I actually started doing exercise research.
Okay.
My PI was not really convinced about that because we don't have experience with mice. Perhaps try to do in vitro stimulation or do stimulate calcium release or those stuff. I was most interested to do it, apply as much as I could. So that's how I actually started doing research over there. And then after my master, I knew I have to leave because if we're gonna do exercise research, I have to move maybe. That's the story.
So even your early stuff, the cells and then the mice, you were interested in reactive oxygen species. So I guess, given that that's your main area now, I wonder how did that come about? Was it like a paper you saw, or again, was it your supervisor was interested in reactive oxygen species, but in some other sort of way, or you know, how did you get to that point?
Yeah, so I remember my bachelor, I had the sport nutrition, and I was assigned to write a review about antioxidant supplementation. And that was my first time I actually heard about antioxidant and ROS. And then in my master, I took a course about oxidative stress. Then I was like, oh, okay, this is cool. And then in Heimoy's lab, some people were studying NOX2 in the context of insulin action. So I thought it would be actually interesting to study in the context of exercise. And yeah, I started this, the first paper we published, and that was 10 years ago. And I continue doing that. But I started doing research in NOX2 related to Duchenne muscular dystrophy. And when I had the paper writing, the paper ready, I was like, okay, I'm describing a mechanism in the wild type cells that is actually not described in mice or in humans. So even though the interesting part was the MDX data, for me was more interesting what was happening only in the wild type cells, because it could be a potential way as exercise work, right? So then I decided, okay, I will stop the MDX research line. I will just focus in the data I have seen in the normal cells, how this contraction can produce these molecules that are called reactive oxygen species, and how they actually could play a role in adaptation.
Okay, so let me just unpack that a little bit. So just, you said MDX a couple of times, you said Duchenne muscular dystrophy. So just so people know, MDX is a mouse model for Duchenne muscular dystrophy. Mm-hmm. Now you said NOX2 a couple of times, so NADPH oxidase 2, correct? Which produces reactive oxygen species. Now you were saying that was sort of messed up maybe in the MDX cells, but it was getting activated with contraction. So you then decided, okay, let's forget that. I'm just interested in what's happening with contraction in the normal cells, so which we call wild type cells. Yeah, so they're not the disease cells, they're just like normal cells. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So what we saw is NOX2 was already activated in the cells with this lacking this protein, which is dystrophin, which is a muscle disease. And when we contract those cells, they were not activated above the basal. So they were already up. And the normal cells were actually activated during exercise, during contraction, and then go down again. So we saw that this muscle disease was actually hyperactivated the enzyme, which was considered bad. If you treat the mice with these pharmacological inhibitors of the NOX2, mm-hmm. you will see in general improvement of the disease. But then how can actually be possible that wild-time or regular mouse, a normal mouse or cells, they actually needed maybe this uh-huh. activation. So we will probably go into that in the conversation, because then you go in biology about having chronic and acute effects of different intracellular.
This is exactly the fun I had applying for grants and things with reactive oxygen species, but also with nitric oxide, which we'll talk about. It's trying to explain something where you're saying, exercise increases reactive oxygen species for a short period, and that's a good thing. But they're like, hang on, but people with diabetes, or in your example, you know, muscular dystrophy, they've got elevated. How can that be a good thing? So as you said, the concept about chronically activated versus, and then trying to explain how you can be chronically activated, but then do an acute activation for a short period, and that could still be a good thing. So we'll get to that more later.
Yeah.
So you're still in Chile, is that right? So I still want to keep going on your journey a bit. So tell me.
And then, I was, when I was in my bachelor and also during the master, I was reading a lot of papers about the Copenhagen Muscle Research Center. And I, of course, knew Ben Saltin and all the Danish tradition about exercise physiology. So I thought, okay, if I want to do more applied physiology, I still like the mechanistics, but I want to do maybe something more applied to exercise. So then you Google a little bit and you read a few papers, and then Copenhagen is one of the places you, of course, is an option. So I think I wrote many people. I didn't get that many answers, but I actually got an answer from Joan Wojciechowski, who was in your podcast before. And he said, yeah, sure. We can see a possibility and options. Tell me about your project. I was already in my PhD in Chile. So I was trying to look for somewhere to do my PhD thesis, even though I already had a project. My project was about the role of reactive oxygen species during exercise. So then I came to Copenhagen for 1 week because I went to the ECSS conference. And then I took the opportunity to have a small trip to Copenhagen to do just a visit. And then I met the people there, I present my project, and then we found out that it was closer to what Eric Ligasilo and Thomas Janssen were doing with RAG1, which is a RhoGTPase, a protein is in the muscles, which is has many functions, but one of the functions is a NADPH oxidase, this enzyme member of the complex. So it was actually fitting perfectly with the fact that they have a mouse model, which was muscle specific knockout mice. So it was perfect to run the project and see whether RAG1 was actually required for NOX2 activation. So I came for 3 months for a short internship, and of course I had it was a whole new environment, a whole new way to work, many difference what I was doing in Chile. So in those 3 months, I didn't get any result, zero result. After 3 months, I went back home with zero graph, zero data, zero.
When was that? I met you in 2016. So was that before that? That's when you came for your
first. It's before, yeah. Okay. Yeah, it was 2015, I think. So when I arrived in Chile with the after, so my supervisor said, "Oh, okay, show me the data." I was like, "I don't have anything." So it was very lucky, and then I wrote Thomas again and said, "Okay, I'm gonna try again, but maybe for longer because I probably need some time to adapt." And he said, "Yes, sure." And then we start this double PhD between University of Chile and University of Copenhagen. So I was enrolled here, so I could do my whole thesis here. And then, yeah, the stuff started to work at some point. Yeah.
That's amazing. And it's interesting, I noticed you didn't say the word lucky, but you said it just at the end, which is fine. So many times on this podcast, people say, "Oh, I was lucky. And I always say, no, you made your own luck. So, you know, like part of some of the people listening here will probably be interested because you're a neuroinvestigator and, you know, what sort of challenges and how did Carlos end up being so successful or whatever. There wasn't any luck involved. You know, you, right from the start, you know, you were doing your applied research and then you were like, oh, this is hard. But instead of going, okay, well, this is the way it is, you started looking around. What else can I try? You took a risk. Yeah. You moved into the medical, probably didn't have the background. You probably had to do a whole bunch of extra study and stuff. You know, and then you looked around and then you went to the conference, you know, so the ECSS, the European College of Sports Science. So there was it was just on last week, I think in Paris. And then you were proactive, contacted people, you didn't get that many responses, you know, and then you came and did a visit, but you didn't give up, you know, so it's not luck, you know, people make their own luck.
Yeah, but what is important, maybe I would like to say it, is sometimes you are a PI, you receive someone from another country with maybe where stuff works differently, maybe you have also language barriers and all that stuff, maybe you need to be patient with those people, right? With people that maybe is making a big move, and maybe patient, you need to patient, help need to a little patient. Be patient. Yeah, exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. So, because if Thomas would or with him for 8 years, he would say he could have say like a, okay, now 3 months you didn't show you are good, so. Won't waste my time, or we don't have the resources to actually maybe spend it in something that will not work, or he still say okay, come. So I was also lucky maybe with meet the right people.
Yes, that's Thomas Jensen. So I don't know, people, I always say I'm in Copenhagen, I don't really explain why, but yes, this is my fourth visit here. So Eric Richter, you mentioned, you said Eric before, so Eric Richter, Jan Wojciechowski, who's been on the podcast. Eric's probably going to be on. Thomas Jensen. So these are all big names. And the only problem with your story there is you said, I was inspired by you know, my papers with Troy Murray and everything. And then you looked around for someone to go, and you went to Copenhagen. Why didn't you come to Melbourne?
Yeah, I think I read most of the papers when I was already here. But it was even more far away. So
No. You know, a good answer is I wanted to switch hemispheres. Yeah, so you're already in the southern hemisphere. So, but hey, Copenhagen with all the history and everything, I think I can't complain, right? I'm here for my fourth time. It's fantastic. Okay, so exactly. So you're here now, and I'm interested to say just some of the other challenges, I guess. So the language, well, thankfully enough, I think we've both found that in Copenhagen everyone speaks English so well, but you've had to learn English. So did you learn, was English something that was taught in school in Chile, or you had to pick that up?
No. Yeah, so in general, so it's because we don't really use English, I would say never, in Chile, so people, it's not, we learn English in a school, but you never had the opportunity to actually use it. So you just forget it. First time I came, it was a bit difficult to understand. So I guess most of the challenges were even bigger because I was sometimes confused what it was, the interaction of the plan or the research, when you have this big experiment with 50 mice, and then everything is so fast, and then you of course will make mistake if you don't really have clarity what you have actually to do. It was one of the challenges, which is still And now I'm writing a lot of papers, grants, but getting better, I think.
So what is your position? So yeah, so when I met you, you'd come back and you were doing that double. That's the other amazing thing I was going to say. We don't have that set up in Australia as far as I know, because you were explaining it to me. I'm like, what? So you get like a PhD through Chile, and you get a PhD through.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a bargain.
Yeah.
And then the support that you get here as well was amazing. The funding and things for.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. So then I got 3 years DDA, Danish Diabetes Academy postdoc fellowship, which was amazing. Then you have 3 years to develop your project, being in Denmark, and it's a huge support. So Danish Diabetes and Endocrinology Academy right now, it's a fantastic organization. You have a lot of courses. You have been there. You are actually here because the grant you got. So I got these 3 years, I finished last year. So now I'm an assistant professor at the department, trying to get maybe a permanent position. So writing grants of papers, we will see, but yeah, that's my position now, assistant professor.
I kind of feel bad now, because I was asking you the other day, if you learned Danish, and you were like, well, I haven't yet because, you know, I don't know if I'm going to be here permanently or whatever. And I was thinking, oh, it's a bit slack. You've been here 7 years. But I'm taking for granted just being an English-speaking person. You've had to actually learn English.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how can you learn Danish?
Yeah.
One of the things when we talked about things to talk about, because we're obviously going to get to the Ross stuff, and that's where we're heading, and we've touched on it already, is you said some of the challenges and you said the importance of the sports science community giving more visibility to early career researchers. So indeed, we're doing that now, but you know, that wasn't something that was originally on the agenda. What were you thinking about there? Just
Yeah, I think it's in many fields of science, you will have this lack of visibility of the early career researchers. So it's sports science is also a thing, I would say. So it's really hard to get kind of visibility, and then you have all the big names, of course, and then sometimes you go to conferences and you expect to see more maybe a space for young researchers in order to actually get experience and get the possibility to present their work and build their own careers. And I think sometimes we just forget. Of course, if we organize a conference, we're going to have the best one in the world, as you are doing in your podcast. But I think happy with this opportunity, because you took this as a thing about having young people and maybe promoting and helping other people to develop their careers. I think it's a thing. We have to work a little bit more in sports science. True. When you go to conferences.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's true, because they're like symposiums, because I've organized symposiums and things, and you don't tend to, if you're organizing a symposium, you always want to get the best, you know, the who's who, as I always say. You want to get the biggest names in those fields, and you don't necessarily think about someone who's up and coming. But I was thinking some conferences, I can't remember off the top of my head now, but some conferences, they'll have, like, there might be 4 or 5 slots for speakers, and that they'll have like 2 or 3 that go to the big names, and then they'll have 1 or 2 that they choose from the abstracts that are submitted. So maybe that's a way that they're trying to balance that up a little bit. But it's tricky, right? Because people, they kind of want bums on seats. You know, they want people to come. If you're organizing a symposium, you want people to come and sit and listen to your symposium and all that. And nowadays, you know, tweet about it and whatever else. It's more likely you've got the big names.
It's really true. Yeah, it's really true. But on the other hand, the data will be the same, because I mean, the one producing the data are the postdoc and PhD. So I guess people will see the same data, same quality, I guess. Maybe it's a way to start, given some of the space, or creating maybe new things, new ways of meetings, right? We had this PhD course a few weeks ago. We tried to put people together the students and the professors, and I think it was really nice and worked really well in the course we organized here in Denmark. You were there, so I think we have to think maybe out of the box and see how to actually create new ways to actually interact in meetings.
Yeah, that was a great meeting. One thing you touched on earlier was that, yeah, the Danish Diabetes Academy. Well, it's actually the Danish Diabetes and Endocrine Academy now, but the funding they have, which is, you could have a whole conversation about that. It's incredible, the funding. So students, even undergrads, but masters, PhD, actually get like a salary to study. And then they've got money for, you know, visiting professorships, which is what I've got, and postdocs. And it's comes back to Novo Nordisk, which has the incredible foundation, which is, has a lot of money for research here. So it's quite amazing. Sometimes I literally apply for grants in Australia where it's like an 8% success rate and it wouldn't get up. And then Eric would put in like a modified version here and it would get funded and then I'd come over. So it's amazing. Okay, so why don't we talk about... your reactive oxygen species work. So we've touched on that a little bit and how indeed you were. So I was looking at the list again the other day. So the young investigators at the International Biochemistry of Exercise Conference, that is just University of Copenhagen, University of Copenhagen, University of Copenhagen. Then there was Monash University, and then there was Karolinska, and then there was David Wright from Canada, and then there was you. And you're kind of University of Copenhagen anyway. So it's amazing. So you're the first South American to win the IBEX. So that was last year, right? I think.
That was last year. Yeah, it was last year, and it was totally unexpected. I was the first one. Hope not to be the last one, but it was so totally unexpected. Like, yeah.
It's fantastic. I just want to ask you about that, because when you say not the last one, I've been amazed. I think you might have started this trend, but how many people from Chile I've met, how did that come about? I think you were saying they have really good science background, right? And then they've got you as a someone who can sort of, you know, they can realize it can happen and you can maybe help them out here and there.
Yeah, you know, yeah. So now in our lab, we are 3 Chilean, 3 Danes. I've been really inspired to actually maybe show the people or explore new ways, and people can see that actually it's possible, and then maybe hopefully inspire someone to try and do it also. So yeah, so I got this IBEC, which was totally unexpected then, and then the same year, for some reason, I got this prize from the Society of Free Radical Research. It's called Catherine Pasquier Award, which is a European prize for one early career researcher in Europe. So I also got this redox recognition in the exercise biochemistry. So I was so happy, of course, also the first one. So was so inspired to actually have impact in both fields, right? So sometimes you combine two fields that in one you are really good and the other one maybe you are not that good. And getting from both the recognition for both fields, the redox, so they say your redox work is good. And then your exercise, the other side, your exercise science is also good. It was really... it's really inspiring, and hopefully I'm not the last one, and hopefully people can actually get more prizes from, I mean, Brazil is really strong in sports science. They have really good people. Chile is getting also good, strong, so yeah.
Exactly. I was actually thinking about Brazil earlier when you said the challenges. There's a guy, Adriano, I hope I get this right, De Souza. He's got like tons of papers. I actually went, he invited me, so he's in Recife, which is spelled with an R. It's Portuguese, it's different, you're Spanish, I know. So it's R-E-C-I-F-E, but it's pronounced Recife, and they say Rio, not Rio. Mm-hmm. And I went there twice, and they just have the same thing. They were just cobbling together equipment, building it themselves, whatever. Mm-hmm. And at that time, he had like 50 papers or something. But he was having trouble getting like a lectureship in Australia. It's just like to break in. And I've also seen, I won't say who, because you can start working out who it is, but I've had a couple of students from sort of the Middle East kind of area that were fantastic. And they'd have all sorts of trouble getting their papers published. And they were literally in the end saying, you know, I ended up helping them out and I was legitimately on the paper, but there's some sort of like, oh, maybe you should go last author, because then they can see, oh, Glenn McConnell, and then I'll make it easier, rather than having their supervisor. Mm-hmm. It's incredible, the challenges that's terrible. That's like a whole different thing. But basically, it's like the reviewers or the editors or something will look at it, and I think, even subconsciously, and not actually think, you know, oh, America, Australia, Copenhagen, what's this, you know, some Middle Eastern country or something, and just they weren't getting accepted for really nice work. I don't know if you've seen.
I think it's moving from that, but it was a lot about that in the past. I heard a lot about that in Chile. So trying to collaborate with people in the US or in other countries just to maybe get the chance to actually pass the editor. I think it's getting better.
That was just such a mind-boggling situation. And also one of the students actually said that she was doing experiments with rats and she was having to pay for the rats and the antibodies and everything herself. So it's just like, talk about challenges. Okay. Yeah. All right. So we've been leaning towards this. So why don't you tell us, what are reactive oxygen species? Like, literally just explain what they are, when they're produced, why are they important? So that's sort of basic stuff. And then we'll get into it.
Yeah. So a few definitions we could start with, it would be, what is reactive oxygen species, or ROS? It's a concept which is a generic name, so people need to know that. So it's a generic name for a group of molecules that are actually very different between them. So they are called free radicals, but it's not the same, because free radicals are ROS, but not all ROS are free radicals. So these molecules are highly reactive. So they are produced in different places of the cell, and then they will interact with the molecules in the cell. So since they are very highly reactive, or that's why they call it reactive oxygen species, they will try to gain stability, taking electrons from other molecules. And that will produce damage in the cells, in the proteins, in the DNA, in lipids. And in general, that could be a signal of stress in a cell. So ROS got a lot of attention in the 50s because they were part of this theory, free radical theory of aging. So Harman proposed in the 50s that they were involved in aging. So basically, aging was an accumulation of oxidative damage, and that's why we age. But then they got a little bit more complicated in the end. But at some point, was really one of the main theories about aging. So those are ROS, those are reactive oxygen species, but we will have different type of reactive oxygen species, some of them radical, some of them not. And then you have the other concept, which is important, which is antioxidants, which are molecules that can actually neutralize ROS, because they will provide electrons to actually stabilize the molecules. And we have endogenous antioxidants. We have proteins that serve as antioxidant enzymes. We have also non-enzymatic antioxidants. And then we have exogenous antioxidants, will be provided in the food or supplements or something like that. So the relationship between reactive oxygen species and antioxidants will give the concept of oxidative stress. So when you have more ROS production than antioxidant defense, you will have something we call oxidative stress, which is basically cellular damage by oxidation. And the last concept we need to introduce is redox signaling. So redox signaling is a kind of a new concept where reactive oxygen species act as a signaling molecules and promote, in general, survival of the cells. So those are the concept we may start with.
Beautiful. Okay. So you've got your endogenous antioxidants. So, you know, we'll talk a little bit about them. Well, actually, why don't we talk about, because people will be thinking, you know, you mentioned antioxidants, you know, that you can take exogenously, which means you take your diet, for example. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your endogenous antioxidants and what they're doing? And I guess we're focusing mainly on the muscle here, but there is like kind of whole body, and there's fat that's also inflamed and all this sort of stuff. But why don't we think about the muscle mainly, I guess?
Yeah, what is fantastic is in the muscle, you have different enzymes, proteins that actually defends muscles against oxidative stress. So they are located in different places in the cell, and they can actually remove reactive oxygen species generation and prevent the damage. So what those enzymes will do is actually remove very efficiently reactive oxygen species. But of course, the levels of those enzymes will vary depending of your physical status, of how healthy you are, how trained you are. And there are differences. For instance, people who is in general athletes, they have much more antioxidant levels than sedentary people. Studies showing that people with these muscle diseases or diabetes, they have less antioxidant defense in the muscles. So you can actually manipulate, mostly by exercise training, the level of antioxidant defense in your muscles. And there is a paper from Mari Carmen Gomez Cabrera from Spain. And the title is, for me, is the best title in the field, is Exercise is an Antioxidant. I would say exercise training is an antioxidant because when you train in the long term, it's the best way to increase the antioxidant capacity of your muscle, but also in other tissues as a fat, for instance.
That's true, because exercise is actually an oxidant. Because exercise, actually, you get production of reactive oxygen species. But you're saying that the better title would be exercise training as an antioxidant, because then you get the increase in antioxidant enzymes. So if we just think about the different sites, because, you know, when I was doing the research with reactive oxygen species, looking at glucose uptake and mitochondrial biogenesis things, there was always this, you know, unclear, is it being produced from NOx2, as you said, but you've also got xanthine oxidase, you've got even the mitochondria, so the mitochondria itself can produce reactive oxygen species. But if I'm right in my understanding, it actually goes down during exercise, if anything, in the reactive oxygen species, because the assumption was it was coming from the mitochondria. But why don't you just tell us anyway, where is the reactive oxygen species coming from? As far as we know, you know, there's lipidases and all sorts of things.
Yeah, so that was the aim of my thesis. So the first description of reactive oxygen species generation in muscle was by Kelvin Davis, University of California, in 1982, I think. So since then, many people, a lot of researchers perform studies doing what is the role of this reactive oxygen species and trying to use antioxidant to block it. But in my mind was like, before blocking those roles or manipulating the roles, you need to know where those are produced. So then I got my research plan for my PhD was like, okay, I want to study the place where those ROS are produced. Then since I had this knowledge about NOx2, I knew was activated by contraction in cells, I thought, okay, maybe it's NOx2 who is driving this increase in ROS production. And then, after 30 years of the first description, we described where those ROS were produced during exercise. And we saw that during this, we saw a cytosolic increase in ROS production during exercise. And we saw actually a decrease in ROS production in the mitochondria. Mitochondria get more efficient during exercise and it produce less ROS rather than more ROS. So if you read all the papers before 2019, and most of them says it was mitochondria, there was a few groups, Malcolm Jackson in Liverpool, they were also investigating NOx2. But most of the group were actually assuming it was a mitochondrial ROS that drive this increase during exercise. And we saw actually the opposite, and we still see it. We are doing more experiments, and yeah, it seems to be cytosolic ROS.
So if you, I know you've done a lot of fancy techniques, and to be honest with you, the ones you've been presenting lately in the meetings are like, wow, just really amazing, you know, transfecting things. And, but if people done, I guess, NOX2 knockouts and contracted them, and they have less ROS production, I guess, has that been done? Or?
Yeah. We use a mouse model, which was deficient, has a mutation in one of the key subunit of this complex. And we saw is ROS production was during exercise was totally gone. And glucose uptake, we will probably talk about that, was also decreased. And in the mouse model that Eric Richter and Lee Casillo used before the RAC1 knockout mice, those mice also have a block in ROS production. So then we showed that it was a cytosolic rise of ROS during exercise rather than a mitochondrial one.
Right, and NADPH or NOX2 is on the plasma membrane, yeah? Is that right? Is it embedded in the membrane?
It's several subunits. Some of them, there are two of them are in the membrane, exactly, but also in the tissues of the fibers. So muscle are special cells because they have the membrane, but they have like a small membrane network inside of the muscle that allows to actually transmit the depolarization of the cells to allow this muscle to contract. So in the tissues, you have NOX2 expression, also in the plasma membrane, but we think the one are more important is in the tissues. If you do a staining of some of the subunits of NOX2, you will see mostly tissue pattern. So.
Okay. So just to explain to people, so, you know, when you send a message from the brain, comes down the spinal cord to contract your muscle, comes to the motor units, the neuromuscular junction. And anyway, so the message is sent along the plasma membrane, which is the outside of the cell, and then down these T-tubules, and calcium is released and you get contraction. Now, what is the signal then that's turning on the NADPH oxidase? Is it the electrical stimulation? Is it an energy deficit in the muscle? Or, you know, what is it, you know?
That's a good question. We still don't know. We think it's mechanical stimulation. But if we inhibit contraction, we still see it a little bit. So we are trying to investigate that, but we still don't know what is the initiator of the signal. That's kind of difficult to study, but we are working on that. We don't know yet.
All right, that's interesting because you mentioned RAC1. So we're getting a bit nitty gritty for some people, but that's thought to be involved in the mechanical sort of the microtubular structure and all that. So that could be linked in there.
Yeah.
Now, as you know, and I always pull you up on this after your talks, I say, well, what about nitric oxide? So, you know, as you know, I've done a lot of work on nitric oxide, and often reactive oxygen species are not just called, people actually will say reactive oxygen and nitrogen species and, you know, put them together. So, do you think there's any interaction going on there? And, you know, we did some work that basically reactive oxygen species and nitric oxide can combine to form peroxynitrite.
Mm.
And some of our research suggested maybe there was some sort of peroxynitrite. So maybe there was an interaction to do with glucose uptake. Do you have any thoughts about any of that? Or is that a bit of a hard one? Because it's hard enough to look at the reactive oxygen species on their own, I guess.
Yeah, we haven't. But I think it's quite interesting. And I think the knowledge we lack is mostly because we don't have good tools, some methodological tools. These are very small molecules. We are working interested in exercise. So exercise is something you can really put in a ditch. So I think we lack information about that. It's, for instance, peroxynitrite is a fascinating area. I think it could actually play a role in many of the stuff we see with nitric oxide and also with exercise combined. But we don't have the tools to actually measure it, especially during in vivo conditions, especially in humans. So we are trying to use a little bit of mass spec to narrow that, but it's a long way to, but mostly because we don't have the tools. It's a difficult area to work, we'll say.
Whenever I do bring that up with you, I always say it's hard enough what you're doing already. So maybe one day the tools come along, or maybe you just make your own tools. That's what I've been saying when you give talks. You don't just stop at whatever tools are available. You just kind of make your own tools. Yeah, now, the other thing is the thing we touched on earlier, which is this short-term increases versus chronic increases. So now people listening, you know, we're talking about reactive oxygen species causing, stress and things like that. People will be thinking, but hang on, but why is exercise a good thing? You know, it's increasing your reactive oxygen species. So maybe just talk a little bit about this sort of chronic, and even the point that both reactive oxygen species and nitric oxide, if they're really low, it's not a good thing. You want like a little bit, but not too much. All those sort of concepts, yeah?
Yeah, that's kind of, I think, my favorite part of the film, because I see exercise, acute exercise, as a stress signal, right? You will activate many of the kinases and many of the cellular mechanisms that tell the muscle you are under stress. You are under maybe mechanical stress, you are under energy stress, you are in redox stress. So there are cellular mechanisms to sense that stress. And then there are specialized proteins inside of the muscle that can actually be activated when you are under a stress. An exercise is a good stress, and depending on the type of exercise, the stress will be the major one, right? In the major role. So in the case of reactive oxygen species, they are a stress for the muscle, and then they will activate all the machinery for modified gene expression, and then will actually promote an increase in the antioxidant defense. And if you put a muscle in mechanical stress, this muscle will increase the gene expression of protein that actually maintain the cellular integrity and are able to increase the mechanical force generation, right? So the muscle really respond to the specific stress you are giving it. If you increase MPK, which you have talked about here as a mechanical, as a energy stress sensor, it will promote mitochondrial biogenesis, because the reading was a reduction in the ATP levels or any kind of energy stress. And then the cell will say, okay, I need more mitochondria to produce more energy. If you produce frost, the cell will say, I need more antioxidant defense to get the defense against all frost.
So the exercise as
a stress that will promote the changes. And basically when you use different intensities, you are just choosing the stress you want to give to the muscles to promote that adaptation.
Yeah, and actually that's an interesting one. Do we know what the best, because I mean, people are going to be, and we're going to talk about it later, people will be wondering, what about taking antioxidants and what about, what's the best exercise? Do we actually know? So what you've explained is basically specificity, right? So that the muscle responds to the stress you put on it. So if you do exercise, you get a lot of reactive oxygen species. The muscle will respond by increasing its antioxidant abilities. Yeah, just like you said, if a muscle is exercising, it's got an energy deficit, it's gonna react by increasing mitochondrial biogenesis to try and increase, to try and reduce the likelihood of having an energy deficit. So what kind of exercise do we know? What kind of exercise? So if you do sprints, repeated sprints, weight training, endurance training, do you know which ones have the biggest effect on the antioxidant enzymes, levels, or does it depend on the kind of exercise? And, I could imagine some, to be honest, I feel like it's too simple. Things are not usually not that simple, that you just have one enzyme that produces all the ROS, so NOX2.
Yeah.
I can imagine, how do you fine tune things? How do you react to different types of exercise, or how do you react if you're diabetic?
That's an interesting one, and it's usually the one we will after describing the mechanism, you will think, okay, which kind of exercise then I have to do. And then in general, that's the time we actually find problems to translate those results, right? So I would say what is more characterized in terms of the overall antioxidant capacity is endurance exercise. Of course, if you do high intensity interval exercise, we have seen it in our hands, we do also see an increase in antioxidant enzyme. We haven't really compared much too much. But you know, you have this this recruitment effect. Of course, if you train low intensity endurance exercise, you will recruit some of your fibers. If you do high intensity interval exercise, you will recruit many of them. So then when you take a biopsy, you will dilute, of course, the effect, and then it's really hard to compare. But I would say if you compare with the strength exercises, I will say endurance exercises is actually much there is more evidence in that kind of exercise than the strength related exercise training. So either you use endurance or high intensity interval training, I think both of them has a profound impact in the antioxidant capacity of the muscle.
Has anyone looked at the production of ROS, you know, different intensities of exercise? So if you do like, you know, 40% VO2 max, 60, 80, 100, a sprint, whatever, I guess it's hard. It becomes hard to sort of match things because when you have a high intensity, you have a shorter duration generally. But has anyone done that sort of work, do you know?
No, I don't think so in the redox field. It's something we are interested in doing it because, you know, it's when you read all the trying to match the work is very difficult. I will prefer to give an overall advice. So if you need to increase your antioxidant capacity, maybe trying to find a range of intensities or type of exercise. And I think it will take a long time to find the exact intensity to promote the antioxidant defense. But yeah, maybe when you're building a training program, you are not only worried about your antioxidant.
It's not your main focus. Defense,
you also want to in your mitochondrial biogenesis, your strength and everything. I think we still need some, especially translational work, about intensities in humans, hopefully to have a range of intensity that protect, especially people with muscle disease. That you see, in general, ROS production, excessive ROS production is a common feature of many muscle diseases. You have many of the muscle diseases will share these redox modifications and oxidative stress phenotype. So one of the key points right now is to find whether this is a cause or a consequence of many of those muscle diseases. And then maybe you can prepare the muscles, increasing the antioxidant defense before with exercise training or with this new range of antioxidants that are, for instance, there are mitochondria-specific antioxidants. You can remove ROS specifically from the mitochondria and maybe do not alter the other rest of the cell, which is something the field should move a little bit more using site-specific antioxidant to remove the ROS you actually need to remove and keep it the one, maybe if you are training, especially keeping the one are involved in the muscle adaptation.
That's very interesting. I think we'll get back to that when we start talking about should people take antioxidants. But just to sort of tie it together a little bit. So with the just talk about the short-term increases in antioxidants you get with exercise, for example, compared to the elevated. So you've said about Duchenne muscular dystrophy. I also know people with diabetes, for example, have the chronically elevated ROS and how that's a bad thing. Yeah, and then and can exercise even help with that? So if you've got this chronically elevated ROS, which is a bad thing, can exercise then by increasing the antioxidant defenses help to fight that?
That's a brilliant point, because it's something I've been thinking for a long time. If you had diabetes, you have ROS elevated in the mitochondria probably. And then you do exercise, which will increase basal ROS even higher, but you see benefits, right? So that's why I've been thinking all the time in this. It's not only if it's chronic or acute, it's also very important where those in the muscle cells are produced. Because in the muscles, maybe people do not know like how the muscle looks. If you look at it in a microscopy, especially electron microscopy, you will see this packet of contractile proteins. There is no room for more or less anything. So mitochondria are, which are the energy source, are packaged in different places between these contracting filaments. There is glycogen, the energy carbohydrate in the muscle. It's also packaged. So there are not much place for stuff to move, right? So there are these compartments. And what we think is, depending where those stuff are happening, which side of the cells are ROS increasing, the response of the cell will actually be different, because everything is spatially organized in the muscle. There is no room for improvisation or putting something in the wrong place. So we really think it's not only the amount of the timing is one of the key factors in this, is where this is produced. And that's why we are trying to study in a compartmentalized way. And that's what we did, our cytosol versus mitochondria. And we think there are more compartments. You can still manipulate ROS in different places and maybe manipulate the levels of antioxidant in different places. This is still very experimental. It's mostly cell and rodent work. But I think the field will move in the future to that, to try to remove ROS in a specific sites.
Right. All right. So then we start thinking about antioxidants here. So, I mean, I'm assuming people will already be starting to think, well, maybe antioxidants aren't necessarily a good thing always, because it depends on the situation. Yeah. So why don't we talk about that? So someone who's got chronically elevated reactive oxygen species, like a person with diabetes and, you know, in their muscle, the pros and cons of taking antioxidants for them versus an athlete who's getting the short increases in ROS during the exercise and then it goes back to normal again. So what do you think about that sort of question about antioxidants?
Yeah, so this is, that's the way more or less the field started. So there was a few papers in the 2000s, one from Jose Viña in Spain, Mari Carmen Gomez Cabrera, and then was old paper in humans in Germany, where people who are taking antioxidants, vitamin C and E together in general, very high doses, some of the training adaptations were not seen. And those experiments were reproduced by many labs. Sometime it didn't work, so it has no effect. But that's what there were methodological differences. But more or less what the field agreed in that time, that high antioxidant supplementation blunts some of the training adaptations. So when we were talking about how exercise work, I will get back to that if you are thinking about taking antioxidants, because if you want the signal to promote adaptive changes, you can remove the signal. But if you are interested in recovery, maybe it's another thing, right? So there was this a train low, compiled high about carbohydrate at some point, right? You train with low carbohydrate level because that could actually amplify some of the cellular adaptations. And then when you compete with very high glycogen. I think we could apply something similar to antioxidants. If you train low, but if you go for a 1 week training or a competition or 2 weeks very extensive competition, long hours, I would say maybe in that case you wanna protect the muscles again, oxidative your stress, and maybe you don't need to get it by supplements, but you can just get it with regular food rich in antioxidants. And maybe in that case you actually, you're not interested in adaptation, you are interested in recovery. And I think that's rationality applied to many of all the way people use to recover after exercise. If you want to recover fast, you will get less adaptation because you are removing the signal from the muscles. And if you're gonna get adaptation, you need the signal control, right? So thinking as an exercise, as a stressor that promote adaptive responses. If someone asks me, should I daily take antioxidant, I would say no. Unless you have a deficiency in antioxidant levels.
Okay, so to clarify, so maybe just drive that one home a little bit there. Because yeah, there's a lot of interest in, should I take antioxidants, should I not take antioxidants? So you were saying, unless you have a deficiency in antioxidants, then you would, I guess, how would people know, they would know their blood levels, how would they know if they had a deficiency in antioxidants in the muscle? I guess they wouldn't.
Sometimes people by diet, they do not consume, for instance, vitamin C, and E levels are low. A recent study from some researchers in Greece, they actually supplement people with vitamin C. The one were low in vitamin C before the study and they were trained, they actually improved much more than the one were not low at the baseline. So if you have low levels of vitamin because you're not ingesting it by the diet, you may be beneficial. It may be beneficial you take the right amount. But for regular people, I would say that advice would not take daily antioxidant supplements unless you are going to a very tough time and you are not interested in the adaptation, you are more interested in the recovery.
And high doses can also have negative effects as well, right? Not just on your responses to endurance training, but even just generally. Is that right?
Yeah.
Do you know many
follow-up studies showing that people that consume high doses of supplements will show overall increase in mortality. So it's
And do you know, I know this isn't your field, but we talked about people with diabetes and people with perhaps muscular dystrophy. I know you mentioned the MDX mice, which is a model of that. Are they improved by having high doses of antioxidants? Or again, is it only if they have a deficiency, do you know?
So what we have seen in at least in rodent studies, if you give rodents antioxidants, general antioxidants, where they have conditions where they show severe muscle damage and weakness and that kind of phenotype, you will see an improvement just by taking general antioxidants. We cannot say whether they are high or low because in general, those are rodents studies, so it's kind of difficult to just use the dose that works. I haven't seen in humans that many antioxidant supplementation study that actually works. And I think it's because, it's just because if you take general antioxidant, you will change the whole redox state of the cell. So cells will actually maybe even produce ROS. If you put in cell culture, if you put too much antioxidants, the cells will start producing ROS to keep the cellular balance of the redox. So I guess many of those trials are just have confusing factor, even removing all the redox state of the cell, and then cells start trying to compensate, producing more ROS, and in the end, it won't have any effect. We have been collaborating with some people here in Copenhagen using antioxidant, mitochondrial specific antioxidants, and seems to work at least in and insulin resistance in humans. Can't say more.
That's interesting. So what are you doing there?
There are a few mitochondrial specific antioxidants, and we have been using them to actually dissect what is the role of mitochondrial ROS in some of the development of antioxidant insulin resistance, for instance. At the cellular level, we can see that it may actually work against lipid, for instance, or many other type of development of insulin resistance. So I think that's the way to go, a specific antioxidant specific to the site where those excessive ROS are being produced, and try to keep the other one, the good ones, along. So if you find a way to actually just remove the bad ROS, we will be able to keep the good ones. That's what we are trying to do now.
So you're thinking that during exercise, the reactive oxygen species are short increases that are coming from NOx2, so the plasma membrane and the tubules, most likely. And then the chronically elevated in people with diabetes and insulin resistance anyway is coming from the mitochondria. Because I don't want people to get confused with saying the mitochondria doesn't look like it's producing reactive oxygen species during exercise, but it may well be producing this chronically elevated ROS. Now, I should say that my former postdoc, Glenn Wadley, because I'll get in trouble otherwise, I'm pretty sure he's shown in humans antioxidants improving people with diabetes as well with some clamps. But it's interesting that you're saying, so you're saying this mitochondrial antioxidant targeting in humans, is that available? Is that just something that's available at the moment for like a trial?
Yes, like,
can people go to the shops
and
buy it?
Get it?
What's it called?
I will send you the paper when it's accepted, and then maybe people can start using it. But I think it's available, and there are a few trials in rodents, but also in humans, getting some benefits of just removing mitochondrial ROS. I think it doesn't make sense that mitochondria produce ROS as a signal chronically. So I would say every time, more or less every time, mitochondria produce ROS chronically would be a bad thing. So if we can actually attack or remove those ROS specifically, and maybe keeping NOx2 dependent on other sources dependent alone and working, I think we are closer to actually be more efficient in the manipulation of oxidative stress.
So you're saying it's available for research, but it's not available. You can't run down to the shops and get it at the moment, that agent. Is that correct?
I think it is. I'm not sure. I haven't tried.
All right. So it's interesting because the point there about the mitochondria, I think, and this is the thinking at one stage, was that the mitochondria is is using oxygen to produce energy. And basically there is a superoxide, which is basically like oxygen, which is a reactive oxygen species. Yeah. And for a while there, people were thinking that was being produced during exercise, but now we know that's less.
Yeah.
But in the person with diabetes, for example, they're on a high-fat diet, it actually makes sense in a way. They've got all this energy that's going into the muscle. What's the muscle going to do with it? So it actually makes sense that it pushes it through. I think Daryl Nufa showed that, right? The high-fat diet, you end up with more reactive oxygen species from the mitochondria. And I think he had a mitochondrial inhibitor. But anyway, that's all very interesting. All right, so a couple of questions. Did you have any comments on that? Did that make sense?
No, it's right. It's right. We see it in the different models in mice and cell culture. If you put mitochondrial specific antioxidants, we see improvement in some of the health parameter of the cells. And our collaborators are also doing it in humans. So I think I think in a few years we will have much more clarity about what is the difference between bad ROS and good ROS, which have been the question since they discovered them. Like, what is good, what is bad? And that's always the question. And I think in the coming years, we will have much knowledge about that.
All right, there's a question from Marco here on Twitter. Why is regular physical activity more effective or not in reducing oxidative stress than taking high doses of antioxidant supplements? Now, I guess we've talked about that, but do you think in this regard that could almost also help the people with diabetes? So the people that have the elevated ROS being produced by the mitochondria, would exercising them and increasing the antioxidant enzymes, even if it's not in the mitochondria, you know, like in the cytosol or somewhere else on the membrane, do you think that can help just to sort of mop it up? Or do you think it's too spatial? You know, you've got the reactive oxygen species in the mitochondria and you've got the antioxidant defense. I don't know the answer. I'm just wondering, you know, somewhere else. Mm-hmm. Can it still mop it up, or is it too sort of separate? You know?
That's the interesting thing about exercise. So since we see ROS mostly in the cytosol, but the adaptation or the changes in gene expression occur in the whole cell. So exercise training increase mitochondrial antioxidant enzymes or also cytosolic antioxidant enzymes. So the signal comes from the cytosol, but the gene expression, which is changed by exercise training and the levels of antioxidants enzymes, the muscles occur in the mitochondria and the cytosol, also outside of the cells. So I think it's perfect as a mechanism, right? You produce ROS in one place, and then you support the antioxidant defense in many places, just in case. Mm-hmm. I think that's why people, one of the reasons why people with diabetes and they are under exercise training and they reduce ROS. That's already shown, right? That's mostly because you increase your antioxidant defense. Mitochondria is usually really good removing ROS. It's really efficient. It has glutathione peroxidase, it has peroxyreduxins.
Oh, okay.
It has superoxide dismutase. So a group of enzymes that actually is much protected than the cytosol against ROS. So what I think is antioxidant enzymes keep mitochondrial biogenesis as a safe process. So without antioxidant enzymes, having mitochondrial biogenesis would be a bad thing. So that's why I think exercise training promote alongside mitochondrial biogenesis also an increase in antioxidant defense.
Okay, so there's the antioxidant defense in the mitochondria as well. I wasn't aware of that, I guess.
Yeah.
Oh, that's beautiful then. Okay, so if you can increase those with exercise in people with diabetes.
Yeah, even though the signal comes from the cytosol. Yeah, exactly.
Yes, okay. Now, I'm aware that I've touched on, and this is, again, probably going to be too complicated for some people, but why don't you tell us the really fancy sort of stuff you're doing? Try and keep it simple somehow, but... what you're doing with your tags, your fluorescent tags and all this inside cells and
Yes, so right now we are pushing a little bit this concept of compartments, a specific ROS defense and ROS production in the muscles. And so in the paper in Nature Communication, what we saw is this increase in ROS production in one place of the cell during exercise and a decrease in the other. So that was kind of okay, because so far people was actually mixing everything, right? And doing lysates and right now we could see in the same cell in decrease in one and increase in the other. So we thought, okay, this should be really well regulated. And then we are trying to explore that and trying to see how those signals are regulated in at the single organelle level. So we are manipulating ROS level in the mitochondria and the cytosol and trying to see which are the drivers of, in one way, cellular adaptation to exercise, but in the other way, cellular dysfunction in insulin resistance and high fat diet. And now we have the tools to do it, because before we didn't have it. So I think it's really exciting, and we will learn a lot about how those signals are increased and what are the drivers of training adaptations, and also maybe some of the drivers of muscle disease as an insulin resistance, or even some of the myopathies. So
you've been very good at keeping it. You've been very good at keeping it simple. But tell us, just tell us how you're doing that signaling, because it's really cool. How are you doing that getting it to the same spot? So you know, you're getting the tag onto a particular protein, which then goes to a particular spot, and then if you get an increase in ROS, it fluoresces, you know, all that sort of stuff. It's very cool.
Yeah. So I really like microscopy. I like to see stuff. So, I mean, Western blotting is good to see the bands, but I like to see the cells, the mitochondria, the plasma membrane. So we're using a lot of live imaging microscopy to use high resolution and also like a highly sensitive ROS sensors. And then we are modifying, we didn't, but we got this sensor to actually put them in different cellular compartments. So now we can illuminate ROS production in the plasma membrane, in the mitochondria, in the nucleus of the muscle fibers. And then after that, we can also manipulate ROS levels. So we can use genetically modified enzymes to produce ROS in different cellular compartments. So if you're gonna do a mimetic of exercise, we produce ROS in the cytosol, and then we can follow those ROS across the cells. Where are those ROS going? So one of the questions was, okay, we have ROS production during exercise, and then what? What are those ROS doing? So what we're trying to follow is how the diffusion of the ROS in the cells and where they can actually reach. Because if this is compartmentalized, you will have production, these ROS staying in one place, and maybe you need to find downstreams the proteins are activated by that they are located in that specific place. So that will help us to actually find the downstream targets of reactive oxygen species, which is something is totally unexplored, because people say we actually says like we produce ROS and then this happens, but how? We need to find like the ROS sensors and the one actually can interact with the sensors, and then how this is translated in a signaling pathway, right? So we're trying to manipulate ROS in different cellular compartments and then see what happens. We see if you produce ROS in the mitochondria, we see insulin resistance, for instance. Just producing ROS, perfect mitochondrial function, perfect cellular function. But if you produce ROS in the mitochondria, you see insulin resistance, less GLUT4 translocation. So how is this actually working? Are those ROS leaving the mitochondria to have the effect, or within the mitochondria is a sensor that will lead to decreasing GLUT4, this glucose transporter, decrease in the plasma membrane that allow glucose to enter. So I think that will give us a lot of information, and hopefully we can finish some of those projects and share it with the scientific community.
It's really nice. So for people that don't know, this is really cutting edge stuff that Carlos is doing. He's driving it, and it doesn't always work. You've got to try lots and lots of different things to actually get it to work, and I've seen that, and good on you for persevering with it. Now, I always try to have practical real life. So I'm just thinking, if I was a person with diabetes sitting here, what should I do? Would you suggest that doing regular endurance exercise? Well, I mean, you know, we're just talking about reactive oxygen species here. Obviously, it's good for them, for their heart and their blood pressure and their insulin sensitivity. But in terms of ROS, you know, this person's like, hang on, so what, should I take my antioxidants? Should I exercise? Should I do both? I mean, what should I be doing? And then maybe we could talk about someone who's like an athlete. What should they be doing? We touched on this, but just to sort of bring it together at the end here.
So I would avoid taking antioxidants in my daily training, especially with people with diabetes.
Sorry, I missed that. What did you say? Sorry, you said
I will not take antioxidants. I will not recommend antioxidants for people with diabetes. And I think the best exercise is the one is done. But if I have to recommend one from the reader's perspective, I will recommend endurance exercise.
And you said for the person with diabetes, you would not recommend any antioxidants, but you would recommend exercise. Yep, perfect. Unless, yeah. I guess, if there was an indication that they were deficient. Is that fair?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yep. And then the endurance athlete, I think you were saying if they were just going along their normal exercise, you would say don't take antioxidants. But if you were doing like a week training camp or something, going crazy, is that what you said?
Yeah. I think, especially if you are in a very high intensity volume together in these training camps and stuff, I may consider if you have especially if you have a deficiency in endogenous antioxidants, as vitamin C levels, for instance, but not in daily training.
Perfect. All right, so I mean, we've sort of half done that, but I'd like to finish up with takeaway messages. So that was kind of takeaway messages anyway. But so what would be, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 takeaway things you'd like people to get from this discussion?
So what I would say is seeing exercise as a stress response adaptation. So I think it really helps when you are thinking on how to train, depending on what is your aim. If you know a little bit about exercise physiology, you see exercise as a stress that will actually promote very specific adaptations depending of the stimuli you are given, right? So removing most of the signals would actually blunt always your adaptation. So it's nice to improve recovery, but sometimes you need the signal, right, to promote adaptation. So that's how I see exercise training to work. And the second is you don't need antioxidant supplementations unless you have a serious problem in the levels or your diet is not sufficient. But in general, regular diets are sufficient in vitamins. And so most of the time I will not recommend antioxidant supplementation, especially combined with exercise. If you are sedentary or you have diabetes, I would recommend doing exercise first, doing the exercise you like, and you have to choose to promote better adaptation from the redox area. I will suggest endurance exercise and combine it with a little bit of high intensity bouts. That will optimize the training adaptations. I think that's more or less it.
Okay, well, thank you very much. It's been great having you on here. Actually, I've forgotten, we talked about glucose uptake right at the start, and we couldn't go. That was my main thing for a long time. That's how you got onto my research, I guess. So what do you think is regulating glucose uptake? Do you think reactive oxygen species are playing a role? We'll just talk about that to finish up.
I think they're playing a role, especially the cytosolic ones. You know, if you stimulate cells with even a simple experiment with hydrogen peroxide, you see an increase in GLUT4 translocation and glucose uptake. But if you put too much, you see a reduction. So, I mean, we get back to this chronic acute thing. I remember the first time I was presenting my project, you were in the group meeting. You say, you look to Eric, I think, like, then you agree with me that the ROS may play a role in glucose uptake, and Eric says, no, we don't think so. Then was like my first presentation in front of Eric, and he was like, my main hypothesis was thought down by him, but then we showed that they could play a role specifically during exercise. We saw a role in GLUT4 translocation. We still don't know how GLUT4, this transporter, is modulated by ROS during exercise, but at least we know where those ROS are produced now.
Great. Yeah, glucose uptake regulation during exercise is a complicated one. And I should say, and it's plugging the book as well, that thanks again for being involved in the exercise metabolism book that I put together. And I guess I was on that chapter as well. I just realized that. But yeah, so anyway, yeah, great to have you on. So
thank you for having me, and was really an experience, and yeah, hope people like it, and yeah, see you around.
Okay, good on you, mate. Okay, I'll see you down the corridor, I guess. Okay, bye-bye.
Yeah.
I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Please like, subscribe, pass it on to your friends and colleagues. Check out the other podcasts. Thanks again.